Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello, I'm Sue Anstis. Welcome to the Game Changers podcast, where you'll hear from trailblazing, fearless women in sport. In this first episode, it's 11 times Paralympic champion Baroness Tanni Gray-Thompson, who, following her extraordinary sporting career, now sits as an independent peer in the House of Lords. This is where she and I sat down to talk about her career. I began by asking her how she got started in sport.
My family were really sporty, so my dad played a lot of sport. My mum loved watching sport, so I think that was kind of just there in our lives. I think I was kind of quite a competitive child, so it's kind of an easy thing to funnel me into. Apparently, I was quite an annoying child, lots of energy.
Surely not.
Didn't stop talking, ever. So I think my dad thought it might quiet me down a bit. And I think, I mean, the other reason, it was actually when I started, it was all about being physically active. It wasn't about kind of a sports pathway. My dad was an architect, and I started using a wheelchair when I was about 6 or 7, I can't really remember, because I'd become paralysed over a period of years, because my spine collapsed. And I think Dad recognised that to push a chair around, I needed to be quite fit and strong. Mm. And it was about being active, and it was about getting the most out of being a wheelchair user. And then the sport sort of came, like the competitive sport came later. But in the early years, it was about being fit and strong enough to push my chair, get upstairs, crawl upstairs, you know, just live an independent life. And then much later, my dad said to me, actually not long before he died, that because I was quite an annoying child, they just didn't want me being completely dependent on them and living at home forever. So, you know, my dad gave me a different version when I was young, but I think that was the reality. And I think they were always really conscious from... I remember having this conversation with them when I was quite young. You know, they didn't... I've got an older sister, and they didn't want her to kind of feel that she had this responsibility to look after me and change her life to look... So, you know, at the time... sort of the 70s, there was a very different attitude towards disabled people. So what my parents were doing was actually really forward thinking in terms of looking at what was best for me.
Clearly your parents were hugely enlightened there. How was the attitude to sport, to a young child in a wheelchair taking part in sport in Wales in the 70s? Were people welcoming? Were there opportunities?
There were actually. I mean, I grew up in Cardiff, so I think there were lots of opportunities there. So because we had really good facilities. So, you know, I learned to swim and I did horse riding. And the primary school I went to was very inclusive before we actually ever thought about inclusive PE. So, you know, I was included in a lot of what was going on.
And you're in mainstream school,
isn't it? Yeah, mainstream. Yeah. So I was the only wheelchair user, I think. I can't remember. I think the only probably very visible disabled person. So, you know, the teachers just, PE teachers just included me as much as they possibly could. And then when I went to high school, which was quite a complicated affair because there was only one school in South Glamorgan that would take me as a wheelchair user, and my dad had to threaten to sue the Secretary of State for Wales over my right to go to mainstream school. So I got to the one mainstream school that would take me. And actually there they were pretty inclusive. So Mrs. Cogbill, my first PE teacher, you know, in... what's now year 7, you know, it was just right, well, swim. I mean, I went to a state school, we had a swimming pool, you know, it was like, right, no, swim, just be as inclusive as you can. Yeah. So that had an impact on me as well.
That's fantastic to hear that impact. I say the teachers, I keep hearing the story of the teachers that make the difference there. And when did you find wheelchair racing? I hear that basketball was a little bit in your history for a brief period.
Yeah, I mean, I love basketball, and I just was completely and utterly useless at it. So I can't throw, catch or shoot, and no skill whatsoever. So I tried, and I remember going to Stoke Mandeville. I was about 12 and watching the men's GB team play and thinking this looked, you know, just amazing. But we didn't really have a team around, or there weren't enough. So the mainstream school I went to, there were about 30 wheelchair users, and there was a special school next door where there were obviously a lot more. But there weren't really enough to form a team and to do training sessions. And I think I learned early on, if you're not going to be able to train, and you're not going to play well. And also, I went to play at juniors, and I think I got fouled off for fighting.
I did highlight that story of you slapping somebody, mate.
I mean, I think...
Is it a bit over-exaggerated?
No. I mean, what happened, we were playing in mixed teams, and this boy just kept elbowing me in the bicep, and it really hurt. And it was just, and he did it when the ref wasn't looking. And I kind of slapped him right in front of the referee. And I remember the referee saying, you can't go around punching people. I went, no, I slapped him, as if that was some kind of defence. And it's like, oh, right, OK. So I think the ref afterwards said, you know, praised me for being sort of very committed. But I think at that point I realised basketball wasn't going to be the thing. So, I mean, I did a little bit of wheelchair racing at that point, but I think I knew then that wheelchair racing was going to be the thing, because actually I could do it on my own. I could train on my own. Yes, you can train with others, but I knew that even at that age that I had to be doing a lot more training than I was able to do to play basketball.
And quite a rapid rise. So started at about 13, I think, and by 17 you were in the national team. Is that the case? It feels like it was a... Right from the start, you knew that was your goal, was it, to represent the country?
Yeah, goal was to compete for GB. And, you know, I joined Bridgend Athletics Club, had a great coach there called Roy Anthony, who never coached a wheelchair user, but just learnt.
That's amazing. I didn't realise that. When I read your background, I assumed that he was already training wheelchair athletes. Yeah, that's fantastic.
But, I mean, Roy, he had a big squad of girls. I mean, you look back now and think, wow. I mean, he had about 30 hormonal teenagers. I mean, he was ex-police officer. That maybe says something about the corrales. And, you know, we had a grass track in Bridgend, and we used to train in the multi-storey car park in the winter. We used to sprint up and down the car park ramps. And he was great, and he just learned and was just keen and willing to do it. So the atmosphere in Bridgend Athletic Club was fab, because... We had an on-disabled runner, Steve Brace, who was one of the best marathon runners in the world at the time. He was part of the club. And, you know, it was a very friendly, open club. It wasn't an elitist club, even though we had Steve, who was incredible. So it just felt a really nice place to be as a developing teenager.
And they must be excited too, as you went to your first Paralympics at Seoul at 19. So how did that feel as a teenager still to be representing your country and getting that kit?
Oh, it was amazing. So I didn't expect to go to Seoul. And I think I was one of the last on the team to be selected. So it was given to me, you know, as an opportunity to kind of step up. And I remember getting the letter. So I'd come home from university. And, you know, Mum was then, she'd, oh, there's a letter, you know, and it had the GB team logo on it. And I remember opening it and just said, it said, dear Tani, congratulations. And I remember just like screaming. Oh. So I've still got the letter.
It's lovely.
So that was really amazing, because I wasn't expecting. I thought I might if I was lucky, but it wasn't an expectation.
It almost makes it more wonderful that it wasn't waiting to hear from the selectors as a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you don't get selected, they just don't tell you. So, and it's only when you ring around to go, oh, you've all had your selection letters, right, I haven't. So, I think, you know, going to Seoul, you know, I'm sort of a million miles away from Cardiff, where I was studying at Loughborough at that point. You know, just the culture, everything was so different, and the games were great. It was the first time we'd had sort of Paralympic Games in the same venues. We had a different village, but, you know, you kind of felt that this was a real step up for the games. There'd been a real evolution.
Yeah.
So Seoul felt
significant.
And also, you know, being youngsters, sort of going around, and, you know, I was studying politics, and, you know, looking at the cultural side and the history of Korea, I had some time off at the end, and we sort of did a little bit of travelling around and seeing, you know, there were a lot of protests against the American army that still had a really heavy presence there. So, you know, we went up to the demilitarised zone. So there was a couple of athletes I dragged. I'm not sure whether they really wanted to come with me or not, but I'm not going on my own. And so just seeing the impact of sport as well as the stuff that I was doing, which is quite selfish, but the impact that sport had on a country and on people. Because before the Seoul Paralympics, you know, a lot of disabled children were, you know, in homes or living on the street. And, you know, they basically picked up a bunch of young people, trained them up to be athletes. And, you know, for them, if they won a medal in Seoul, they got a flat and a pension. So, you know, that's huge motivation for those athletes.
Yeah. And you've mentioned a couple of times Loughborough, obviously, best university in the world. Delighted to be a fellow graduate of Loughborough. How was university life for you?
It was good. I mean, it was quite mixed. I think at the time they didn't, you know, they didn't have many disabled athletes there. Mm-hmm. There was somebody who played basketball and there was me. And so some of the training facilities weren't accessible. So, like, the track wasn't accessible.
Yeah, I was thinking that. The student bar. I was actually thinking about you at Loughborough as to how accessible it was. And
not great. So I was in Towers as all a residence. So the bar was upstairs.
Yeah.
So we used to have to crawl up and down the stairs. Okay. You know, to get to the track. So there's a really low wall, which everyone could jump over except me. So trying to, you know, training was not easy. So a lot of the gyms weren't accessible. But actually what I learned quite early on is actually instead of trying to do my circuits with the athletics squad, I joined the mountaineering club. And they were brilliant. I mean, just completely crazy bunch of guys. But really welcoming, really open. Their training was much more suited to what I needed. So even though my experience at Loughborough was quite mixed in terms of accessibility, I found a way through.
Yeah.
And I kind of thrived in spite of some of the access issues.
And clearly, we, you know, had this phenomenal career path of all those years. Are there any that are particularly, that you look back now and think there are any that were the most significant in terms of world records broken or world championships and so on?
There's a few. I mean, some of the best races I ever did weren't races at major games.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I looked at success in lots of different ways. And I think if someone says, what's your top 10 races, that they'd expect to be Paralympic finals. And for me, I just looked at it all in different ways. So I remember being in Gothenburg in 95 and knowing on the start line that I was going to break the 400 world record. I think that's the only time I ever had. Because of my training, where I was, how I was pushing
competition
and on the track. Yeah. And I remember just looking at the wind direction with the flags in the stadium and thinking, I've just got to go for it. So you don't get many days like that. I think coming back after having my daughter Karis, you know, there were lots of people who at that point thought I should retire. Athens was a really difficult games for me, so I went from completely screwing up my 800 metre final, which was my strongest event, and coming back and winning the 100, which is my weakest. So, you know, I still think that 100 is probably the best technical race I've ever done under that type of pressure. Because, you know, there were people who thought I should have left the games, gone home, or, you know, just did lots of interviews where they're saying you're too old. Thanks for that. I think I was 33. So, you know, it's stuff like that. So mostly a lot of what you remember is just the other stuff that goes alongside it that people don't see. You know, some of the camaraderie, travelling with your mates, or, you know, coming back on a team flight with 150 kit bags, which are identical, which is a joy. You know, so it's that stuff where they go, you know, oh, Sydney must have been amazing. Or I remember sitting looking at all these bags going, oh.
Mine's there somewhere.
Yeah, where's mine? And so, there's all this other stuff, which is quite hard to articulate.
And do you think you had the chance to enjoy those wins? I mean, when I look at how prolific you've been in the gold, and actually you've been within one championship winning 2 or 3 medals. Did you get the chance to enjoy that? Or were you always looking forward to the next medal and so on?
No, I don't think I enjoyed it really until I stopped, because I think I was always looking forward to the next. Yeah. So it's, I mean, if you're doing multi-events at a games, you just have to, you know, if you win the first one, you have to go back, eat, sleep, drink, you know, water, you know, and refuel for the next. So, you know, pretty much I was competing throughout the whole of the games for most of the champs I went to. So, you know, I think Athens, I was competing first day of athletics and my last race was my last but one event at the games. So you don't kind of get to, you know, I wasn't there as a tourist, but I mean, Seoul, I think I was, but that was a very different stage in my career. All the others, I was there to win or to do the best I could. So, you know, and you come home and you have a couple of weeks off and then you're back into training.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, I think I always just knew I had this limited time. I mean, I competed for a long time in the end, but I didn't want to ever retire and think, oh, if only. So, you know, for me, it was a lot of choice, but I didn't do. You know, I trained and competed and did other stuff around it, but competing was always, and the next event's always the important one.
And obviously some disappointments along the way. You don't win everything without losing some too. And how do you think as a person you've dealt with that?
I think, you know, my first few years competing, although I was improving and I knew I was and I could see my PBs getting better, I didn't win a race until I think I was 16. So I've lost a lot of races. And that's kind of part of it. And I think my parents had a very balanced view of it. Was, you know, you go to the start line in the best shape you can be and you do the best you can and you might make a stupid mistake or the wrong decision or someone's better. And it's not great at the time, but it's how you step away from that and rebuild and come back. So, you know, sometimes winning's not always easy to deal with. I mean, it's easier to deal with than losing, but sometimes the pressure that puts you under doesn't always help. Or people just expect you're going to turn up and it's going to be easy.
Yeah.
Or so I think I had a relatively balanced, as much as you can, balanced approach to it. You know that everything's like a stepping stone to the next thing that you're doing.
And obviously 30 world records across those years, which aren't yours to keep, like the medals.
Yeah.
And how has that felt as they, I guess, as the first one, second one, as they've passed to other people? How does that, I'm just interested to know how that feels, is there?
So my 200 world record went, I think, within about 6 weeks of me retiring.
And didn't think about coming back to...
And it, you know, it happened when I was competing. I mean, I think for me, when I retired, you know, that's it, it's done. You know, there's nothing, can't do anything about it. And it's kind of funny as you see sort of athletes coming through and being hugely successful. So like Dame Sarah Storey, you'd be going, oh, well, how do you, are you gutted she's got more medals?
You're delighted. Your emotion when she won 12, her 12th gold.
It's brilliant because it's like, you know, if I could have done something about it, actually I still would have been really pleased for her, but I can't do it, you know, I can't do anything about it. So, So Jess Garley, American athlete, broke my 200 record. I sent her an email and just said congratulations because, for me, I look, she was an athlete who had always sort of just sort of about been there but not quite and made it through and hadn't kind of quite got to her potential. And so to see her actually just push, you know, this world record time was actually really
cool. And it's progression, isn't it? It's life moving on and other athletes coming through, yeah.
You don't want sport to be, you know...
static.
Yeah, or just, you know, world records... in some athletics events, world records there for a long time,
for
lots of different reasons. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you don't want it to be static. You want other people to come through.
And aspire to that. And it's interesting, you know, that you compete until you're 35, which is quite a... Well, you were married then, and you had a child.
Yeah.
So I guess, how do you feel that time in your sporting career was different to those early days?
Having Caris I'd never held a baby. So I was, honestly, and you know, the conversation was like, oh, wow. You know, after Sydney, it was like, we've got Manchester Commonwealth Games in 2002, and wow, we need to have a child, kind of now. So if we're going to do it. So, you know, luckily that kind of worked out, but... I mean, it was easy when she was little because you could just travel the world with a baby and stick it in a pram. And the great thing about wheelchair racing as a sport, you know loads and loads of people. So I had all sorts of people looking after Caris when she was a baby. And it got hard when she started school.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember one race in Bedford. I was doing a 400 metres. So I was probably away from her actually, I warmed up with her there. So I was probably only away from her for about a quarter of an hour. I think she was probably about four. And I came back and she had an ice cream. And it's like, where'd you get that? And she said, oh, John, and gave it to me. And he was one of the officials. So I kind of went over and said, oh, thank you for, you know, buying her ice cream. And he said, oh, well, you know, we walked past her and she sat there and said, Mummy hasn't had time to buy me an ice cream because she's really busy. And it was like...
She's a shrewd girl, isn't
she? Yeah, so I had to go around all the officials and go, do not listen to my child. Yeah, but there is a real family atmosphere, so that was lovely. So loads of people kind of babysat Caris. Yeah.
And I guess your approach to training and competing over those 13 years, do you think that changed significantly? Did you like training?
I like training sort of 10 times a week. I'm not sure I like training 15 times a week. But you have to. It was just what you have to do. So, I'd say mostly I did like training because it's also a means to an end, because you can't be on the start line. You can't get in the team unless you're, you know, in good shape. So my training changed quite a lot from being a young athlete, which, you know, developing slowly and learning and putting stuff together. We generally trained for 49, 50 weeks of the year, and you'd have periods in that where you're dropping down or picking up a bit. But... I think one of the things I was able to do was also train quite smart.
Mm.
So, you know, we now call it prehab. There wasn't a word for it when I was competing, but it was basically looking after your body. So I was doing rotator cuff exercise, looking after my shoulders, you know, from my early 20s. So, you know, my shoulders aren't great, my elbows aren't great, there's lots of bits of me that aren't great now. But they're not as bad as they would have been. Because to me, it's not just about doing the training, it's about your diet, it's about your chair, it's about all the other things, about sleeping.
Yeah.
And I am quite focused, obsessive. Actually, not now I've stopped competing. I'm still quite, but not.
What was your family saying? Yeah,
it's all on scale. So, you know, when I was competing, it was just that's what you have to do.
And there's lots more talk now around transition, and I feel like, especially in the last 5-10 years even, of people recognising that is a process with that organisations there to help athletes. So how was that for you, that transition from full-time professional athlete to the next stage of your life? Do you feel that was a smooth transition because you knew what you wanted to do?
I think it was okay. I mean, I still think it's challenging. I mean, my dad was always, you know, from being young, he was like, right, you can mess about being an athlete once you've got your degree. Okay, Dad. And they were hugely supportive, but, you know, Dad fairly regularly was saying to me, so what are you going to do next? Like, well, I haven't retired yet. And yeah. So I think actually that was helpful, that I was thinking about other stuff. So, yeah. You know, I sat and Sport Wales and Sport England and UK Sport and did lots of other things while I was competing that fitted in with my competition schedule and the training. And I think that was important to have other skills because you never know when you're going to retire.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'd pretty seriously planned my retirement for 3 and a bit years before I stopped. So what I thought would happen, because I was just mentally and physically broken and tired, and I just had enough. And if I'm honest, the sort of the final year, I was a bit tired of people saying to me, oh, you're that athlete, aren't you? And I remember thinking, right, when I stop competing, people are going to stop saying that to me. And it's great, I don't have to be this athlete anymore. And 12 years into retirement, people
they
say,
still do.
They go, oh, you're that athlete, aren't you? And so there was about 6 months afterwards where it's like, oh, just get a grip, Tanny. Yeah. You know, just, it's actually really nice. And I think, and I heard Matt Pinson talk about it. And he said it took him some time to find some peace with himself. And I think that's good. And
your sense of self, your new self, as it were.
Yeah, and I think, again, I was lucky because my family never, I wasn't just an athlete to them, but to lots of other people, you are just an athlete. So I think my family gave me a lot of sense of perspective. I remember I've been training in Australia for 3.5 months and I came back and like family dinner. And after about 10 minutes of me waxing lyrical about Australia, and my dad was like, right, you kind of rang home a couple of times a week, you wrote a couple of times a week, you trained a lot, you went out on New Year's Eve. Did you do anything else? And I was like, well, not really. And he was like, okay. And then he said to my sister, right, now how was your day at work? and so that was actually really good to have that kind of... So, yeah, it was... and I kind of joke, you know, first time before Christmas, somebody stopped me in the street and said, oh, you're that politician, aren't you? It's like, yay!
Yeah, yeah,
that's... But now it's okay. You know, someone else stopped me the other week and said, you're that athlete. And it's like, I've retired. He went, who have you? I hope so, because I don't think I look very athletic anymore. So, no, but it's just, you know, people are generally lovely. So I'm very privileged because of my life in sports. So, you know, it's okay.
And you're obviously a post-athlete career. People will know you from the broadcasting side. But you, as you've mentioned, you've sat on so many boards and sports boards in England and Wales and so on. So I guess, how do you feel you go about choosing those roles? I'm sure you're approached a lot to get involved in things. What do you have to decide what you take on?
I think I'm very privileged because for the vast majority of the time I get to work with people I like.
Mm-hmm.
So if I like people, then that's a really, really, really privileged place to be in. You know, for me, I'm really interested because my route into sport was via physical activity. You know, sport, well, at least sport kind of looks after itself, but if we don't have young people being active and everyone being active. So for me, that's a part of and disability rights. So they all kind of intertwine. And I think my dad would... I mean, I did have a real job for a couple of years, a full-time job.
What did you do?
I worked at British Athletics as a development officer. Yeah. So 96 to 99 or 2000. So, you know, but my dad would always say I never had a real job. And when I actually came to the House of Lords, he said, well, it's still not a real job, is it? Okay, thanks, Dad. I think it's... I'm lucky the stuff I get to do kind of mostly fits together.
Yeah. And you mentioned disability rights. Obviously, you're such a well-known campaigner and activist now, really. Do you think things are improving for people in the UK as we are here today?
It's really mixed. Some bits have got better, but I think some of the attitudes have got worse.
Mm.
And so I think, you know, a lot around the portrayal of disabled people is you're either a Paralympian, so you must be all lovely and warm and cuddly, or, you know, you're a benefit scrounger. And there's not always a lot in between.
Real normal people.
Yeah.
Like, trying to live their lives. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's really difficult. So in terms of, you know, getting into education work, it is challenging. So I've had some of the worst discrimination I've experienced in the last 4 or 5 years than I had 30 years ago.
And why do you think that is? Why is that? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? When you think about the elements of racism within football, and, you know, it's a very sad side of society seems to be changing on the negative side.
It is because, you know, I remember thinking 30 years ago, oh, in a couple of years, racism from sport will be gone.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, no, oh, no. And so, I mean, I think we do sort of have these sort of cycles. Mm. But it is quite worrying that, I don't know, I mean, you can't blame austerity for everything. But I think at times like that, people do turn in on themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and the dreaded Brexit word, you know, I don't think that's helped anything. It's clouded out everything else. We're not debating in politics. You know, we're not tackling issues in the NHS, universal credit, all these things, because Brexit swamped everything.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think that's helped. You know, the last 3 years, we've just not done some of the stuff we should be doing.
Yeah, the compassion.
And what can we do, I guess, as individuals, what could we be doing to help transform the discrimination, as it were, towards disabled people in society?
I think it's just sort of treat disabled people as people. You know, there's a hashtag on social media, which is Ask Don't Grab, which Dr. Amy Kavanagh started. She's visually impaired. And it started off as a bit of a joke. And then, you know, as a visually impaired person, she's constantly walked across the road she doesn't want to walk across. Or the other joke is, because she happens to work near the RNIB, loads of people stop her every day and go, "Are you going to the RNIB?" And she's like, "No, we don't live there." It's things like that. I just kind of ask people, yeah. Don't just sort of
assume
or don't just assume that you can't do things. I think for me, the biggest challenge is if someone asks, "Do you want help?" And I say, "No, I'm fine, thank you, but thank you for asking." Some people will still then help me.
Yeah. Right, okay.
I still push. Yeah. So I called somebody in Canary Wharf, asked if they want any help. I said, "No, I'm fine, thank you." I mean, the fact I had a rucksack on my back, one on my chair, my handbag on my knee, I was talking on my phone.
Yeah.
So I probably looked like I wasn't very...
you didn't know you needed it, but you need it. Yeah.
And I said, "No, I'm fine, thank you." And she just carried on pushing me anyway. And it was like, I don't want to be... Yeah. So some of that stuff, I mean, some of it's funny. I'm quite resilient about a lot of that stuff.
And I guess at least that way people are trying, they don't quite know they're trying to be kind, but actually just ask a question and give what's needed.
Yeah.
It's interesting, I've talked about social media, but there's some fantastic stuff that you've shared, some threads. There was one a couple of weeks ago about a girl trying to go out with her friends to a nightclub. Anyway, makes me well up now thinking about it. Just such powerful stuff. So I think the power of sharing those stories of social media to open people's minds to what it's like in terms of accessibility.
I tweet a lot about trains.
Yes.
A lot about trains. And it's funny, one of the train operating companies said to me, "What will it take for you to go away?" It's like, well, I just want the same miserable experience of commuting as everyone else. And I'm not there yet. So, I don't want it to be perfect. You know, that's not real. But I think sometimes the power of social media is quite good. And the other thing is that, you know, being in the Lords, if you write to a train operating company or someone on headed paper, they kind of have to reply.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if they don't, you know, I'll go to the transport minister.
Yeah.
So it's knowing how to work through that and find an effective way. Because actually probably some of my campaigning, I've been more effective and changing attitudes on social media.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Than I have them sitting in loads of meetings.
I think for me, I've learned so much following the stuff you've shared and opened my mind to things that I wouldn't have thought of before. So there is that power to reach millions through that too, isn't there?
Yeah, and it can be really useful. So, I have had a few people who've said to me, they've stopped following me till I stopped tweeting about trains. it might be a while.
Bye then.
But some of it's, some of the kind of the fight I really enjoy as well.
Mm.
So my sister said to me recently, "You're like a little mogwai or gremlin. You know, don't feed a tip water on her or talk about trains after midnight because it just sets me off."
Maltesers.
Yeah. And so, it's some of that. Because I just think I do have a platform and it's not always easy. But, you know, I just think my dad told me when I was really young that I was lucky I had a really good education and really supportive parents. And he, I remember when I was probably about 18, 19, saying that I had a responsibility to make sure, to try and help make sure other people had the same life I had. And we're nowhere near that yet. So, you know.
Does that stay with you? That's kind of driver for you?
Yeah, and apparently he told me when I was 21 I was going to end up in the House of Lords, which I do not remember the conversation at all. Because people say, "Oh, well, that was that part." But no, I don't remember. And the other thing, when I got here, Dad was like, "Well, I told you that." Okay, thanks. So my sister remembers. I don't remember it at all, but anyway.
And has that been a positive experience for you in the House of Lords?
Yeah, it's an amazing place. I mean, it's just people are very open and very helpful and they want to beat you when you're good in the chamber. So, when you're in the chamber, it's very equitable. So I've never felt patronised here. I've never felt treated differently. You're an equal. And that's an amazing place to be.
And people are here because they want to do, at the end of the day, that's why, for whatever reason, whether we agree or disagree, they're here because they want to make a difference and do good.
Yeah, because you don't have to be here. You know, nothing makes you come. So, I firmly believe you accept the title, should come.
Yeah.
But, it's, I found just some amazing people. I found really, really helpful people. So, when I was working on the Welfare Reform Bill, I had government peers help me rewrite amendments to make them better. They didn't always vote with me, but you can find a lot of collaboration here.
Yeah.
So actually, a lot of the stuff I learned from sport transfers really well in terms of, you know, finding the people that, that share a similar view, you know, just... It's almost like putting your training group around you.
Yeah.
You find people that you work on similar issues.
And what are you most proud of in since you've been in this role and position, would you say?
Probably, I mean, welfare reform was a really tough bill to do. I mean, I didn't win any votes. I changed some bits. It's much harder to articulate or to measure success these days. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, as an athlete, because it's gold medals.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Silvers and bronzes only count if there's a tie for gold. As lovely as they are, but, you know where you are as an athlete. It's much harder to do that. I mean, I think some of the work I'm doing around train access and that kind of the persistence, I think, you know, we've now got, you know, train companies talk. But, you know, again, I have loads of help on the outside. I have people on social media who engage with me, which gives me a way to have a discussion. You know, so it's not me. I've got loads and loads of other people around and about who help do that. So, yeah, if we can make train travel better, that would be
a huge thing. Yeah. And you obviously study politics. Has politics, as in not crossbench, been an option? There's a couple of leadership at the moment. You throw your hat into the ring there. I think you do an amazing job.
Being a crossbench is quite nice. Actually, the best and the worst thing about being an independent is no one tells me how to vote.
Yeah.
I love it. But there are days when you come in and there's a vote and you're like, what is that? Hang on a minute. And so, you know, I only vote on things if I can explain in five sentences why I voted on something.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes that you think, I don't know which is best. So I think voting is massively important. I don't kind of throw away any of my votes.
You haven't answered my question there, have you? Might it be in the future? Or?
No. I'm quite happy. I think, if I jump to a party, you can't go back. So I think I personally can do a lot more as an independent. And I don't really like being told what to do. So I don't think I'd cope very well.
And you've spoken, and we've talked about a lot of the causes that you've backed around, many, and gender equality as well. Mm. And also the body issues facing young women and athletes and so on. That's something you've been quite vocal about in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge challenge. Actually, I think for young women, there's so much more pressure. And increasingly young men, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be just girls who had to worry about their hair and makeup and all things like that. And it's much wider than that. I think, you know, there's huge pressure on to look a certain way, have the right handbag. You know, you have the right handbag, you'll be happy. I mean, I can't blame the Kardashians for everything, but I think...
For a bit, yeah.
Well, yeah. But there's this sort of, this unreal world out there. And, you know, some of the... pressure on girls, you know, to be a size zero. It's the size of a 12-year-old girl.
Yeah.
It's not possible in a balanced environment to have that.
And what do you think we can do to change that?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it you can't dial back on, you know. Have a look at some of my school photos. Wow, there's some interesting haircuts there. So, you know, I wouldn't want to say to young women and boys, no, you shouldn't
Don't explore yourself.
Yeah, you know, you should. But actually, I think there's a lot more education around, you know, photoshopping, things like that. Yeah. You know, if you can afford a professional makeup artist and they spend an hour doing your makeup and airbrushing it, I mean, they can make anyone look amazing because that's their job. So I think it's just having that kind of
reality check.
I think is quite important. But I do worry. And maybe, you know, I'm sure my parents worried about me. I worry about the pressure that's on young people, you know, to be on social media, to be on Instagram, you know, the pictures, sort of the pouty pictures you see.
And I guess that's what we hope, that sport might help and make a difference. But I know many sporty girls who are still... The other side of the life is still very much social media appearances, trying to aspire to conform to what's there.
And I think one of the challenges for female athletes, it is can be still based on how you look.
Absolutely.
And, you know, sponsorship can still be very heavily based around that. And I think it's interesting, you know, now you're seeing more face products for men, Liverpool Football Club, advertise face products and hair products. You know, what's happening is there's going to be more pressure on young men to look and behave a certain way, and whether that's having lots of tattoos or your hair cut in a certain way. So I don't think the pressure's going to go down. I think it's maybe going to become more balanced,
but
in the wrong way.
Yeah. Well, they're all coming down. Yeah.
So I think that's pretty tough. But, you know, we have a lack of female coaches, lack of women in leadership roles in sport, lack of female agents, and the cycle... can perpetuate.
Do you feel we're moving in a positive direction? Do you think things are changing there?
I do think, yeah. I mean, I speak to more women who want to come into sport, into, you know, the admin side. I think sometimes it's hard to get your foot in the door and it's hard to challenge some of the stereotypes that exist. But this is where I think, you know, sport shouldn't think of itself as different. If businesses have to have 50-50 representation on the board, sport should be the same.
Yeah.
And I take quite a harsh view. You know, governing bodies have had a long time to do that.
So a lot of public money.
Lots of money. And just do it.
Yeah.
You know, and so I still occasionally hear, oh, well, there are not enough good women. So my response is, yeah, no, there are loads of good women. They just don't want to work with you. I think it's good. But we do need to do more to have more women in leadership. Yeah,
And calling it out, I guess that's the thing as well, isn't it? Counting the numbers and, you know, raising awareness. It's a positive on social that at least we can spread the word more, perhaps make some more noise around it too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for a lot of female athletes, for a lot of athletes, it's hard to know what to do in transition.
Yeah.
And I think there's just more we can do around giving everyone and young women, helping them to get some more of those skills. So when they transition out, they do have options. Yeah. And not just coaching, because just because you've been a good athlete doesn't make you a good coach.
No,
I know that from experience. Yeah. So, you know, it's because I don't want to be kind of looking around boardrooms. I don't want to ever be the only disabled person in the room, or the only disabled woman, or the only woman.
Yeah.
And that has changing, but I just like it to be a bit quicker.
So now, final couple of questions, if that's okay. So the podcast is called The Game Changers, so Trailblazing Extraordinary Fearless Women in Sport. You tick lots of those boxes. As you look back, I guess, in another 30 years, what would you like your legacy to be?
Oh, gosh, that's hard one. Hopefully it's not just what I did on the track, because that for me was quite a personal thing and quite a selfish thing, and it's what I wanted to do for me. So hopefully it's beyond that. I'd love it if, you know, we have loads of women who think sport and physical activity on lots of different levels is something that's for them, and they feel part of it. And I'd love to be able to, you know, whatever I'm working on, have 40 women's numbers that I can ring to ask for help instead of 40 men and 5 women.
Yeah.
You know, that way. So, you know, that would be the ideal. Not easy to measure, but I spend some time with young athletes, women, and who are coming close to retirement, just trying to give them the step. I had people who just gave me a step up and who gave me the chance. So, you know, in my mid-20s, I sat on the National Disability Council, which oversaw the implementation of the Disability Discrimination Act. And so for me, it's trying to help young women have some of those opportunities to learn and develop.
A huge thank you to Tanny for being so generous with her time. It was a real privilege to hear her talk about her life with so much openness. It's easy to see why she's had such a huge impact, both on and off the track. I'd love to hear what you think about the Game Changers podcast, so please do leave a review or give us a rating. It makes a massive difference and will also help us to spread the word about these amazing women in sport. To make sure you don't miss out on future episodes, please subscribe to the Game Changers. And you can find out more about all our guests at promotepr.com/gamechangers. Next week, you'll hear from the utterly extraordinary 4-times Ironman world champion, Chrissy Wellington. It's a fascinating conversation where she talks very openly about the highs and lows in her incredible career.
Sport, if we're pushing ourselves, is about learning to endure discomfort and self-doubt and pain. Yeah, I experience that in all of the different races and challenges that I've done. But definitely over the course of an Ironman, it lasts a lot longer.